Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. May marks Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month, and we are celebrating all this week. Our next guest book, Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion, has landed on several AAPI month reading lists, including Brooklyn's Greenlight Bookstore's list of featured titles for AAPI Heritage Month. Her name is Gia Tolentino, and you probably know some of her work as staff writer for The New Yorker, where she writes about cultural shifts, large and small. A lot has happened since she joined us to talk about her collection of essays back in August of 2019. She's released a debut fiction piece via Amazon Original Stories in a collection called Currency. She's one of the eight authors in the collection, and her piece is titled, I Would Be Doing This Anyway. She's also given birth to a baby girl and, of course, continued to provide us with her searing cultural commentary and insightful reviews all through the pandemic. But so many of the things we talked about during our conversation in 2019 remain prescient, even now a couple of years later. The essays in Tolentino's book span a range of subjects, from her youth in Texas as the daughter of Filipino immigrants and her brief stint as a teenage reality show contestant, to her thoughts on online activism and even the commodification of feminism. I started the interview by asking her about the book's subtitle, Reflections on Self-Delusion.
I wouldn't have a subtitle, honestly, if not. Apparently, I had to have one, and I found out later that I had to have one because otherwise people will think it's a novel. That makes a lot of sense to me. So if I had my druthers, I wouldn't have one. I think they're cheesy. They sound sort of like PhD sort of dissertation titles. You know what I mean?
But you had to come up with one.
I had to come up with one.
So Reflections on Self-Delusion.
Yeah.
How did you arrive at that one? And why is it the great sort of unifying structure?
Yeah. So the book, you know, there are nine essays about things I'm obsessed with or was obsessed enough with to write, you know, arguably too many words on. And I think that, you know, they're structured around situations in my life, circumstances in today's culture that seem particularly ripe for self-deception. And I think there are a lot of them. And they were sort of the idea of the trick mirror thing. I was thinking about the internet. There's something about the internet that sort of is set up to make you feel like you're looking out. You can see the whole world, but it all sort of looks like a reflection of yourself. Mm. And I think there's something interesting about the architecture of the internet, the way that it makes knowing yourself sort of a mandate and an impossibility at the same time on these platforms, these social media platforms that are sort of structured around personal identity. And I thought that was interesting, the idea that it was mandatory and also impossible to understand yourself while on the internet. And so I thought I would write about other situations where, you know, they seem to give you certain ideas of yourself that may likely be false.
So the title of the chapter is give you a sense that everything is coming at you at all times.
Yeah.
The eye and internet, reality TV me, always be optimizing, pure heroines, ecstasy, the story of a generation and seven scams, we come from old Virginia, the cult of the difficult woman, and I the dread. And the other thing I got from this, especially because you start with the internet, is, you know, you've grown up in a time in your generation where you've had just incredible access to information.
Yeah.
Just so much information.
Definitely too much access.
More than any other generation, which is really kind of interesting to sit and think about. So you said too much. What do you think the access to all that information has been on your generation?
Well, there is, it's true, those titles altogether and probably reading the book altogether, it is something that will, for better or worse, reflect what it's like to be alive right now, which is, it tends to feel kind of chaotic. And I wanted to see if I could write something that was about that, but as clear as possible as it could be about that, you know, that reflected the world in its complication and sense of sort of acceleration and overload, while also providing some sort of clarity and like a path through. But I do think, you know, it's definitely been a condition of my adulthood. And I think, you know, I actually think it's much worse for Gen Z, for sure. But I think something that I have felt as a near constant condition that the internet enables and creates is this feeling that you can know infinite amounts of information about anything, while the feeling of sort of the feeling that you can do something about any of that stuff or do anything besides offer an opinion on it, that feeling is shrinking. Hmm. And that sense of you can know everything, you can do less and less, that seems to be kind of a condition of art. A felt condition of our time to me.
My guest is Gia Tolentino. The name of her book is Trick Mirror. And just, you're in your early 30s, right? Just so
yeah.
When we say
yeah, yeah, I'm 30, yeah.
So you talk about feminism a lot in the book, which is, and it's so interesting, all your different ways in, and your essay, Always Be Optimizing, telling women to get better at being women and all the various ways we're told to do that. And it's such a, it's about sales because, you know, Always Be Optimizing is from Glengarry Glen Ross, always be closing, right? Always be closing on a deal. So you write, feminism has not eradicated the tyranny of the ideal woman, but rather has entrenched it and made it trickier. What's trickier?
Well, yeah, you know, it's funny. I think that you learn, you start learning, you know, even for me, I feel like I've been at age 30, I've grown up at a time where I have had many more freedoms available to me from a younger age than, you know, anyone 5, 10, 20, 30 years older than me. And I'm very aware of that. At the same time, I think, you know, most women understand as young girls that most of what is presented to you about how to live is about how to continually be better somehow at being a woman, right? How to be prettier, how to be more successful, how to be more appealing, how to run your household better, how to be a better mom, all that stuff. And something about that, just something about that feels really gender specific and also monstrous. And I think, yeah, so that quote you read about feminism not eradicating the tyranny of the ideal woman, but entrenching it, making it trickier. I think let's go back to like the mid-century where you would get, let's say, women's magazines and they would tell you all these things about how to look better, how to be, you know, more pleasing, and it would all be for your husband, right? And now there's, you know, there are more things we can do to be more beautiful and more appealing, and the idea is that we're doing it all for ourselves, and it's kind of feminist somehow, that like self-improvement itself, becoming successful, getting rich, being beautiful, being able to perform that as if that was sort of a primary feminist project. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very marketable idea, you know, like success-based feminism sells, you know, a kind of feminism that's built around women being rich and pretty, you know, and like good at presenting themselves. It's easy to sell ads against, and, you know, a feminism that's built around raising the minimum wage to $20, $25 is much harder to, you know, you're not going to get like Dove putting millions of dollars behind that. Or maybe we can. I don't mean to be pessimistic.
Well, it's so interesting. One of your conversations in the book, and I feel like there were conversations, like it's one of the ways you write, which I love, is I feel like you're talking, I'm having a conversation with you. You just can't hear me.
That makes me so happy. Thank you.
I'm like, yeah, Gia. And how about that other thing?
Yeah.
And it's one I found myself falling into. And I am a grown up. And I am, you know, my nieces are your age. Is that idea of falling into the girl boss trap?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm attracted to it at the same time that I'm repelled by it.
Completely.
You know? Yeah.
Will you share with our audience that sort of that trap of girl boss?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's back to what I was just saying. Like, so that word girl boss, it really, you know, grinds my gears. But I think that, yeah, that has been, you know, post Lean In, that has been this idea that this is what feminism is like being a girl boss. Like this thing that's just totally built around.
Just even the way you just said it.
It's just this thing that's built around like individual women's prominence and success and like this sort of. And actually, the thing that most irritates me maybe about the term girl boss is that theoretically this is supposed to be a term for women's success, and yet it's so unbelievably demeaning. You know, like the designation girl boss is so, you know, I find it like the word badass, like it triggers a bit of, you know, it's just feels deeply condescending. Like you wouldn't refer to a man as a badass. You know, like the word, like I once wrote an essay for the Times Magazine a few years ago about the word empowerment, which I also, there's something often that the way it's actually used, you know, it's just a lot of press releases about what's empowering. And it's like, what can be sold with the word empowering? And I just kept thinking, I can think of nothing more empowering than to never have to hear that word again. You know,
my guest is Gia Tolentino. The name of her book is Trick Mirror: Reflections on Self-Delusion. All right. So we talked about the things that aren't going particularly well with this modern version of feminism, the making it a commodity, taking words and actually words that should be uplifting and turning them into just another way to sell something. What is something that's going right?
A lot of things.
With modern
thank
feminism.
You for asking me that question, because I do worry that, you know, I don't want to seem like a cloud of doom and gloom. I mean, I'm fully aware that I owe basically my entire career to I mean, I could say that I owe it all to commoditized feminism. Mm-hmm. Like, the fact that you can sell ads against it has probably allowed me to have a career in journalism much more easily than I would otherwise. And I'm grateful for that.
You admit to it on page 180.
I admit to it on page 180. And also, you know, I'm also very conscious of, you know, I think within the last 10 years, feminism, and you saw it especially in Me Too coverage, feminism has become more and more a kind of mainstream and in a lot of circles a default way of understanding the world. I think we now understand that, you know, sexual assault is a social problem, right? It's not a woman's issue. It is a problem for everybody. I mean, we're obviously not quite there completely, but I think that you saw in the Me Too coverage women were centered kind of automatically, and it wasn't like a niche feminist thing. It was just the right way to cover that story. And I think you're getting that more and more. And, you know, there are certain things like we understand, for example, where, you know, if a man is calling a woman shrill, you know, or crazy, it might mean that she's just speaking, you know? and I think we've gotten better at understanding that, and this is a vocabulary that people have. And you know, I think I interview a lot of college students and teenagers for my job at The New Yorker. I like to report on young people mm-hmm. things because I feel that they're not often, you know, treated well in the media. And girls that are, you know, in high school, college now, they have kind of, a lot of them have grown up understanding, you know, what's changed between when I was in college and what they're experiencing now is already quite different, and I'm grateful for that.
The chapter called Pure Heroines was so interesting because I think that probably a lot of our listeners were big readers.
Yeah.
When they were little, you were obviously a big reader. You talk about Lauren Gulse Wilder and Harriet the Spy, Hermione Granger, and just how they have, as they transition, in many cases, especially Little Women as well, how they transition from being these sort of engaged, active girls mm-hmm. to what they have to give up to be acceptable women. Mm-hmm. What do you think that adult fiction these days could learn from how we think about girls in childhood fiction before they have to become women?
Yeah, so that essay, I'm really, that essay is for all my nerds out there. it's just like, my editor was like, it's kind of a book report. And I was like, but those books are so good. Like, it was about, you know, when you're little and you read children's fiction, it's so many of them are about little girls, and the girls are like so brave, so adventurous. Mm-hmm. And then you get into sort of adolescent, sort of bell jar, virgin suicides territory, and they're all really like depressed and desirable. And then you move into Madame Bovary, Anna Karenina territory, and they're like super bitter and they almost always die. And I was like, oh no, I only like the children. Why? What's wrong with me? And I started thinking about that. And, you know, I think that one conclusion that I reached was that, you know, it makes sense that there are so many brave girls, so many depressed teenagers, so many bitter women in fiction, because I don't think we make enough space for them in the real world. I think there's a reason why women's domestic unhappiness is such a tenet of adult literary fiction. It's there for a reason. It's like women were writing about these problems, you know, like Jane Eyre, definitely Jane Eyre mm-hmm. and Jane Austen, and like all of those books. Those books were about, you know, so many 19th century novels are about like a woman's inability to access independence without the financial patronage of a man. And I think that adult fiction has always been, you know, addressing what is lacking in women's lives. And, you know, as like that Tolstoy quote goes, like, it's like most novels are just about unhappy people. It's just how things are. Maybe that's more narratively interesting. But I do, you know, there is some sort of like lingering desire in me to see something of the like incredible tenacity that those childhood heroines have and that so many adult women have, to see some of that reflected in more complex ways in contemporary fiction now. And I think that we're getting it, like the Ferrante novels. I think that's one of the mm-hmm. Those novels sort of complicated the tradition of what the heroine would become.
You don't shy away from putting your own personal stories in the book. You are, you know, someone who observes culture, being out there, you also take time in the book to let us know about you and about your family and about decisions you had to make. I'm particularly interested in your time in the Peace Corps.
Yeah.
What from that time do you use today as a writer for The New Yorker?
That's a great question. I think I came back. So I was in Kyrgyzstan. I taught English in this 1,000-person village, you know, deep in the mountains in Central Asia. And it was a wild time, you know, like the government was overthrown 7 days after I got there. There was a genocide, like there, I was constantly in trouble, maybe my fault, maybe not. And, you know, I was sexually harassed constantly, like my host father kissed me. And I had a hard time with it because, you know, where in real life, you know, whatever chip is missing in my brain has always allowed me to, like if someone ever harassed me, I mean, I will say I've been lucky, you know, quote unquote lucky, and escaped like severe harm. But, you know, I'd just be like, screw you, you're a loser. You know, like, look at you trying to, like, you know, hook up with a teenager, you know. Mm-hmm. But in the Peace Corps, you can't think like that, you know. You're just not there to assert superiority in any way. And it hurts to try to do that. But yet, that's my only coping mechanism. So anyway, I had quite a time. And I ended up leaving early. And when I came back, I think it was just, in general, my strongest and possibly my first real education in the vast chasm between, you know, moral clarity about a situation and your ability to do anything about it, you know, between understanding the injustice of a system and having any way to really make any dent on it. I think it just, I think it made me, I was always inclined to think in terms of systems and power, but I think it brought it all into relief, like just the scale of the systems that we're enmeshed in, and kind of how good intentions just don't always translate. And that's something I think about on the internet a lot.
That was my conversation with Gia Tolentino. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of the book Trick Mirror, Reflections and Self-Delusion.
You come to The New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.